Hello, this is David Gordon Koch reporting for the NB Media Co-op. You're listening to NB Pod. This edition features a presentation by energy systems analyst Ralph Torrey. He's the research director for the Toronto-based organization Corporate Knights, and he was recently in New Brunswick to present his research about a renewable energy plan for the Maritimes. This presentation took place at the Fredericton Public Library on October 23rd. It was recorded by volunteer Drew Gilbert. You can find Drew's video and more information about the event on our online publication, nbmediacoop.org, or on our YouTube channel. One note before we go to the recording, Ralph did email us with the following correction. He referred to New Brunswick's future population reaching 10.5 million by 2050. In fact, he meant to say that the projected population for New Brunswick is 1.05 million by 2050. With that out of the way, stay tuned for the presentation.
I'm still learning how to talk about this work I've been doing because it's a fairly large project. It's consumed me for the past year, if you don't count the 40-odd years getting ready to do it before that. It's somewhat technical and quantitative, nerdy, and yet the conclusions and the consequences of the results are of, I think, very profound significance that needs to be communicated and translated to a wider audience. This is the first talk, really, where I've attempted to present the results of the study in a way that won't have you all falling asleep by 6:30. And so forgive me if it's a little rough around the edges, but this is the first time out. You're the first audience, really, to see the final results of this work that we've been doing. It's called the Climate Dollars Project. It's sponsored by a number of Canadian philanthropic foundations, which by itself, by the way, is scandalous, if you ask me, that here we are in 2025 with a guy like me with one foot in the grave having to take charitable foundation money to do what every government in this country should be doing at full steam, which is having groups looking at how we're going to get through the climate change crisis, what kind of strategies and policies and we need to address this problem. And yet here we are in 2025 without a national plan. Most provinces don't have a plan. Many cities do, to their credit, including Fredericton and Moncton and St. John. And the cities have led on this in so many ways. But by and large, we are not where we should be, given that it's now been at least since 1988 in the Toronto Conference, when climate change was first put on the international agenda, at least since then, when the scientific community had warned the world that this problem is serious enough that we can't lose any time in addressing it. And we've wasted so much of that last 40 years nearly, not really coming to terms with it. So thanks to these foundations, McConnell, the Ivy Foundation, the Trottier Family Foundation, the Chisholm-Thompson Family Foundation, and the Grainbach Foundation, who have all contributed to keeping me and the team that's worked on this going over the past year. I want to start, before getting into the study itself, by just saying a little bit about maps. This was the best map of the world in 1490. This was the map that existed when those early ships set sail from Europe for China by sailing west from Portugal and so on, thinking that when they hit land, they would be in the Orient. Only 27 years later, this was the best map of the world. And by the way, map makers in those days were like highly valued individuals because people understood the importance of finding out what was out there and producing the charts and the maps that were needed in order to be able to navigate and better understand this world. And by the way, when these maps were drawn, the Earth was still the center of the universe. Galileo's work didn't come along for another, it was nearly another 100 years almost, I think, before the phases of Venus and the telescope finally put to rest the idea that the Earth was the center of the universe. Copernicus had not yet published his heliocentric theory. And that had been basically the prevailing paradigm of where we thought we were in the scheme of things for over 1,500 years. That Earth-centric model of the human position in the scheme of things had prevailed for that long. Now everybody knows it really looks like this, right? And if there's any Australians in the room, you'll be quite pleased. But also, I think if you're like me, if you look at this map long enough, you'll get a little bit uneasy because it's not what you're used to looking at. And again, our maps of what's out there in the literal sense in the case of these maps of the world, but also in the metaphorical sense of the maps that we have to work with of where we're headed, where we're coming from, what the future might look like. This is how we get through the day. This is the way we understand where we're going and where we're coming from. This is where we get our touch points of reference. And of course now, since this famous photograph was taken, we understand just where we are in the larger scheme of things. Not only is the Earth not the center of the universe, it turns out neither is the Sun. And so the story goes. And we have been re-evaluating and rethinking our understanding of where we are in the scheme of things. We are on a spherical planet. It has limits. It's open, but only to the extent it receives energy from the Sun. Otherwise, we're on our own. It's a beautiful system. It has this tiny film of bio life-supporting atmosphere and biosphere around the surface. It is so thin that if you were to go up instead of, if you were to drive towards the airport here, but instead of going that direction went up, you'd be dead long before you got to the airport. The thickness of this little film of atmosphere that supports everything in terms of human civilization and all other life forms is quite thin compared to the size of the planet. It's pretty resilient, but we're testing that resilience. We have been polluting it. We have been upsetting the carbon and nitrogen flows. We have been challenging what are limits to what the planet's major ecosystems are capable of handling without reaching either tipping points where they radically collapse or transform themselves or otherwise changing in ways that will be deleterious to the support of civilization. This is the unknown territory of our age. This is our new world. We've got to figure this out. We've got to map it. And we've got to go there. We've got to leave the past. This is the refugee's mentality. I don't know how many of you know the poetess Warson Shire's work, an African poetess, who wrote a powerful poem about the refugee experience, the last stanza of which goes something like, nobody leaves home until home is a hot breath in your ear telling you, run away from me now. I don't know what I've become, but anywhere is safer than here. We're there with the environmental crisis. We cannot afford to stay where we are. Whatever risks may lie ahead, whatever uncertainty may lie ahead, we've got to go. And it's past time when we need to go. And in many ways, the work that I'm going to be describing, as nerdy and as technical as it may seem, is a bit of a map-making exercise where we've been trying to think about what would a post-fossil fuel civilization look like? And in particular, what would a post-fossil fuel Canada look like? And more specifically, what would it cost? What would the capital investments be that would be needed in order to transform our buildings and our transportation systems and our industrial production systems into a post-fossil fuel energy system. Energy is only one of those limits that I talked about. It's a key one. It's an important one because it controls the carbon balance and all of that. But it's the one that this study is focused on. We started out basically with the question, this is a crisis. This is an emergency. We took to heart what our governments say but don't act on, which is the climate situation actually represents an emergency. And we asked ourselves, well, what do you do in an emergency? Is the first question that you ask, what would be cost effective? No. That was not what anybody asked when COVID came along, for example. And we spent four times more per year responding to COVID than we need to respond to climate change. And I don't remember a lot of conversation about, is this worth it or not? So our attitude going into this study was, we've got to stop this peak of greenhouse gas emissions, which you can see on the far right-hand side of this graph. And this goes back to 800,000 years before the present. So you can see the extent to which this sudden, sharp shock that has occurred in the last 150 years or so represents, in physics we call it a delta function or a gamma function. That is a hammer blow to the system. It will not tolerate that in a smooth way. It will cause disruption and it will upset the apple cart, if you like. And that, of course, is what we are seeing in some of the pictures I had up a moment ago in terms of what happens when you start increasing the amount of energy that's trapped in the atmosphere. It's not just that the average temperature goes up, it's that the system is thrown way out of whack. You think about how you feel when you have a temperature of 2 degrees Celsius and what's going on inside your body. Well, imagine something as large as the global climate system having a temperature of that extent. So we need a new map because the one that we've been dealing with is not generating the sustainable results that we need. This is a very common depiction of the relationships between the environment and the economy and society. It's completely wrong. Just as the Ptolemaic epicycles that said the Earth was at the center of the universe were completely wrong. They were beautiful and symmetrical, but they were wrong. What, for example, is the type of economic activity in this chart that is taking place outside of the environment in this area here? What's going on over there? It makes no sense. The new map looks more like this. It's more a question of concentric circles, where we understand now that our economy is embedded within our society, which is embedded within the Earth system. And that system has got limits. And we have to govern ourselves accordingly. And there's a few pretty simple rules. One, everything goes somewhere. There's no real waste. Waste is an economist term, but you won't find ecologists really using it. Everything is connected, which means you can never really do just one thing, try as you might. And nature is an independent power. This is something I really learned from Ursula Franklin. I don't know if any of you had the privilege of hearing her speak or getting to know her, but she was truly one of the great Canadians, chairman of the Science Council, first engineering female professor, University of Toronto, etc., etc., and a powerful thinker and speaker. And she would lecture about the importance of understanding that you can't negotiate with nature. You can't say, well, would you settle for 2 degrees, you know? It's chemistry, it's physics, it's the flow of material and energy. It will obey the laws of chemistry and physics. And we have no choice but to govern ourselves according to those simple rules. It's that simple. David Brower, the American ecologist, used to say, we are at war with nature. World War III has begun, and it's the war with nature. And unfortunately, we're winning. And he would go on to say, you know, the only option is unconditional surrender. And let me, with those kind of contextual remarks about how I see this research and analysis as something of a map-making exercise, delve now for the next 15 or 20 minutes into some of the results of the work that we've been up to. The project Climate Dollars has three big objectives. We wanted to quantify the investments that it would be required to decarbonize the Canadian economy. That's mainly what I'll be talking about this evening. We wanted to then also quantify what we're currently spending. That's such a small number compared to the first one that the gap between the two is large, no matter how accurate your assessment of current spending is. It's so woefully short of what we need to be doing that it's that first number that we've really focused on, is what is it that we need to be doing. And then finally, which is this, what this meeting this evening and many more meetings and in the future represent, is we're trying to take this out and engage thought leaders and citizen leaders and opinion leaders in the various key sectors about what it would take to get the levels of investment up to where they need to be in order to decarbonize the economy. And we picked 2050 as our time horizon. These are a few of the basic parameters of the work. We did assume population growth of 0.9% per year. That takes New Brunswick to about 10.5 million by 2050. All new buildings have to be efficient and electric and ready for vehicle-to-grid technology. I'll say a bit more about that later. Existing buildings, we have to convert all of them, essentially, to heat pumps. Improving their efficiency is also important. But if we're going to eliminate fossil fuel consumption in buildings, the conversion to heat pump technology is the workhorse that will get that done. We do the same with commercial buildings, some improvement in their thermal efficiency, but conversion to heat pumps. We convert all of the personal vehicles and all of the trucks, all of the road transportation vehicles to electricity by 2050. And then for the industrial and agricultural and non-road electricity sectors, we're still analyzing the details of what the investments to decarbonize those sectors would look like. But because we wanted to include an analysis of what a decarbonized and renewable electricity sector would look like and not leave out what we know will be significant new electricity consumption from the industrial sector, we did make a quick and rough and ready analysis of electricity growth in the industrial and non-road electricity, non-road transport sectors, is what that should say. And it goes up by about 60% in the scenario. This covers data centers, economic growth, and electrification. It's not a complete electrification scenario because there are still some industries, like cement, for one, where it's not clear what the path to a zero carbon future looks like. We assumed a Trans-Canada superhighway of electricity from coast to coast. This is a high voltage DC transmission line that every province could feed or draw power from at converter stations. It's a key concept to smoothing out what would otherwise be very uneven challenges that will face Canadian provinces in decarbonizing. In particular, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Ontario. It'd be very difficult for them to decarbonize if they remain siloed in their electricity systems, but if they can trade and get access to the surplus wind resources in Manitoba and Quebec, to a certain extent in British Columbia, the whole thing becomes much cheaper and the benefits get distributed in a way that looks a lot more like Canada than if we stay locked up in our siloed electricity systems. There isn't any new nuclear in this scenario. We did put it in some of the variations, but every time we added it and ran the integrated model, the cost of the decarbonization scenario would go up. We left the rebuilds that are already underway in Ontario. They're in here. The first of the so-called small modular reactors, I have a hard time calling them that because I live close enough to the one they're building in Ontario to know that there's nothing small or modular about it. And when I was writing the report, I said, you know, I'd really like to point out that this is not the right term for these reactors, which are 300 megawatt reactors. It's a big machine, you know, much bigger than a house, maybe a little smaller than this library, but not by a lot. The trouble is that the word misnomer applies only to nouns. So I went to my artificial intelligence assistant, and I said, what's the word you use when adjectives are being used incorrectly? And it turns out it's a, are you ready for a new word? It's a catacrisis. And if there's two of them, like small and modular, then it's catacrises. And so I have catacrises in my draft report. I know my editor is going to complain. I'm going to fight because I think it's going to force people to stop and reach for their dictionary and remember the point. But in any event, we did leave the first of those in because it's under construction. The contracts are signed. As you may know, however, on a per kilowatt basis, the small reactors are actually even more expensive than the big ones. At least they think they will be. Nobody really knows for sure because this is the first one. And then we had reference solar and hydro for all the scenarios. It was really the wind and the nuclear where we did the most variation. I'll say a little bit more about that as I get into this. I'm going to jump right to some of the conclusions in case I run out of time later. One of the surprises was that the cost is lower than we thought it would be. We first did a back-of-the-envelope effort in this during the spring of the COVID pandemic in spring of 2020. And so did the Royal Bank a few months later, and so did the federal government maybe, although we think maybe they were just quoting us. And the Queen's Institute also did a number. And everybody said, this looks like it could be 5 or 6% of GDP and maintain that for like 20 or 25 years to really get off fossil fuels. And we were seeing numbers like that around the world. Since then, not only have the costs of the technologies come down, but as our research has substituted information for assumptions that were being made in those early studies, we're beginning to understand that it looks a lot more like 2 or 3% of GDP. It's quite a manageable number in the context of a rich country like Canada, where capital investment runs in the $450 billion a year range. This needs maybe 60 or 70 a year maintained over a 25-year period. We can do that. Not only that, but we'll talk a bit more about where that money could come from or where it's likely to come from. We found, as I've already mentioned, or as you probably already know, the key to this is electrification of our buildings and our vehicles, combined with making sure that the supply of electricity is renewable. This east-west transmission line that I described is, for Canada, quite an important feature of keeping the scenario down, cost down. If you put that in, it reduced the costs by anywhere from $100 billion and up. We use the electric cars in our scenario for the storage. Why build big utility battery plants when you've got 29 million electric personal vehicles sitting there parked 95% of the time and only using a small share of their battery capacity on a typical day? So this is called vehicle to grid, and we built that into our scenario. Obviously, we need the utility batteries in the short term while we're building out the electric vehicle fleet and the charging infrastructure. But I'm absolutely convinced that in the long term, the electric vehicles will be the short-term storage that we need to support a renewable grid. And there's ample. I mean, you need less than, most days you can get by with like 3 or 4% of what's available. And if you have a long cold spell, you might use 10%. So you don't need all the drivers to buy into it. You don't need all of the cars to be plugged in when you need the power. You just need enough of them that you can grab the sunlight when it's available in the middle of the day and feed it back from the cars in the middle of the night when it's cold and you could use the extra electricity. it probably goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. We need innovation in business strategies and regulatory structures. That's what's holding us back. It's not a technological path that's holding us back at this point. As I said, there are some sectors like cement where that is still an issue, but the overwhelming challenge of decarbonizing a rich, advanced country like Canada is not a technological problem at this point. It is a human organization problem. It is about getting ourselves organized and getting the financing systems organized and the regulatory and public sector investors lined up in a way that we can make this happen on a timescale that matters to our original objective, which was to see if we could do this quickly enough to make a difference to the climate change problem. Just turned it off. There's some really big opportunities, and there won't be too many more of these wordy slides. I've already mentioned that the existing buildings will have to be converted over to heat pumps. And we have 25 years to do this. It doesn't have to happen by tomorrow. The same goes for electrifying the vehicles. The trucks will come a bit later than the cars, but we need it to happen fairly quickly. Given the lifetime of cars, you really want all of the new cars by 2035 to be emission-free electric cars, or by 2050 you're going to have a problem with gas cars and diesel trucks still being on the road. Wind turbines are the heavy lifter, the prime mover of going renewable in a northern cold country like Canada. Solar may be king in China and the United States and southern Europe, but in Canada and Scandinavia, you'll find that when you look at what's possible given the huge amount of energy that you need to get through the winter when the sun is least available, wind ends up emerging as the most important new renewable source for providing the almost doubling of electricity supply that will be required. So let me show you a little bit of some of the New Brunswick demand results. What you're looking at here, maybe I should pause there. Are people okay, or looking for not hearing any snoring? Any questions?
You got it.
Okay, I'm still going. All right, so we'll get a little bit more pictorial now for those of you who prefer pictures. I know I do. So this dark shaded part, this is electricity use, and this lighter shaded part up top, this is fossil fuel use. And it's measured in units of energy here, petajoules. Petajoules is a whole lot of energy. I'm not using kilowatt hours here because I'm comparing fuel and electricity, and fuel is not normally mentioned and measured in kilowatt hours. So there you have it. The current situation in New Brunswick, as many of you know, is that a very high, relatively high percentage of your residential buildings are already heating with electricity. Some of them with heat pumps, more heat pumps here per capita than most other parts of Canada, but most of that electricity is baseboard still. And I think 72% of residential energy use in New Brunswick is electric. That's very high. Only Quebec matches or exceeds that. And then the dark line, those are the greenhouse gas emissions from the chimneys of residential structures in New Brunswick. So as the fossil fuel goes to zero, so too do the greenhouse gas emissions drop from, looks like about 35 megatons, down to nothing by 2050. So this is what electrification looks like. You electrify the end uses, that eliminates emissions at the point of end use. Now your problem is focused on making sure the electricity that's being provided here is also emission free. I can tell you though, the heat pumps are so efficient, and this is true for electric vehicles as well, that even if you still have some fossil fuel in your electricity system, your emissions will be lower once you start converting to heat pumps and electric vehicles. They're just that much more efficient. This whole story, actually, is about moving away from fire, to bring it back to that almost anthropological frame. This is about moving away from combustion. It's kind of ridiculous to burn ancient sunlight in the form of fossil fuels, to boil water, to raise steam, to turn a turbine, to make electricity, to heat water, to make a cup of tea. I mean, it would be funny if the results weren't so tragic. And cars are even crazier. I mean, we're just one step above Fred Flintstone with his feet paddling underneath. We're controlled explosions of fossil fuels with an efficiency of maybe 10% as a way of creating forward motion. It is so primitive. What electricity offers, and you know, I'm sure that someday we will look back and say we'll move beyond this, or maybe we will, is the potential to vastly improve the efficiency with which we get the things we need, the mobility and the comfort and the other services that energy provides, without the fundamentally inefficient process of burning stuff. Or nuclear, for that matter. Nuclear power plants are actually less efficient than fossil fuel power plants. And there's no getting away from it. This is, in thermodynamics, this is the Carnot efficiency. You can't beat it. So that's a little footnote on why the transition to electricity is such a godsend in terms of opening up a pathway for humanity to move beyond combustion in a way that can help stabilize climate. The story is different from province to province, which is the reason this study has taken a year instead of 3 or 4 months. We realized after we got into it, in Canada, you can't do a Canadian greenhouse gas transition study. You have to do a separate one for every province because of the role of electricity. And because every province has a different climate, a different starting point, a different housing stock, and so on and so forth. And this just shows you, for example, in provinces like Alberta, where there's very little use right now of electricity for space heat, for them to convert their residential buildings to electricity, to heat pumps, results in a much steeper growth curve of electricity use than the one we were looking at for, well, I'm showing Atlantic Canada here, which is pretty well level. New Brunswick is actually slightly negative. Ontario has the same problem as Alberta. Strong growth in electricity is going to result from the transition of residential buildings to heat pumps because we heat mainly with natural gas in Ontario. Quebec, like New Brunswick, will actually achieve negative electricity consumption in its residential sector for the same reason it will happen here in New Brunswick. And here what you can see, and there's a bit of color here, on the left, this is the New Brunswick electricity use in the residential sector I was showing you a moment ago from 2025 to 2050. And you can see it actually declines. And this is the electricity for heating. And these are the other things, you know, the appliances and the water heat and the lights. And over here on the right, that sliver on the top, which is a lighter shade of green than the bottom, that's the contribution from the new housing that will be required to support the population growth I mentioned earlier. So even allowing for a growth of the population to 10.5 million, with all of the new housing that that will imply in New Brunswick, the goal in this province can be and ought to be absolute reduction in residential electricity use while converting all remaining fossil fuel use in the residential sector to electricity. One of the good news results that comes out of this study, and it's truer here than it is anywhere else except Quebec, it's a huge advantage for New Brunswick. And it illustrates why it's so important when doing this kind of work to go province by province, because the stories are significantly different. We did the same analysis for commercial buildings. So it's the same chart, only this time we're looking at the results for commercial buildings. And here again, you can see electricity use does grow for the commercial buildings as you phase out fossil fuels. We made conservative assumption after conservative assumption as we were doing this work. So, for example, we assumed that institutional buildings like libraries and schools and hospitals would grow just as fast as the population. And that commercial buildings like retail and offices would grow at the rate of the economic growth that we had assumed, which was like 1.8% real per year for the next 25 years. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, how much new office and retail space is going up? There's a big, big transition going on in the bricks and mortar contribution to things like retail and business that is not captured in our study. This is assuming that everybody's going to keep shopping in stores and working in office buildings and all of that. and that governments are going to keep building schools and hospitals just as fast as the population grows. Maybe here, not going to happen in Ontario. And so we get some growth in the commercial sector. I'm going to try and speed up a bit here, just watching the clock. Same two charts as I showed for residential. Again, you can see the contribution, the much larger contribution of the new commercial buildings. Without them, as with the residential sector, total electricity use in commercial and institutional buildings in New Brunswick could actually decline in an electrification scenario. This I find so interesting. I'm going to take a minute to explain it. It's a hypothetical neighborhood. On the top, we have four houses. Four of them are heated with electric resistance heating at 100% efficiency. And the black house, the odd man out, is heated with gas. And they use typical amounts of electricity for appliances and water heat and all of that. And they all have a car which is burning gasoline, 80 gigajoules a year of gasoline per car. So the result, the four homes use 436 gigajoules or 120,000 kilowatt hours a year of grid electricity use between the four of them. And total emissions, this is a British Columbia example, so I won't bother going into the emissions because their electricity is very different from here. But then what you see on the bottom, same neighborhood, only now the space and water heating has been converted to heat pumps, and the homes have been retrofit to higher efficiency, not deep retrofits, but say, I think about 15%, we're down to heat requirements down to 75 gigajoules from 115. So it's not what would be called a deep retrofit. In fact, 75 gigajoules is not uncommon with new housing now in some building codes that are being applied. Heat pumps with 260% seasonal efficiency. It might be a little high for New Brunswick, but not much. 20% improvement in appliance and lights. That's just going to happen anyway. Electric vehicles at 20 kilowatt hours per 100 kilometers. And two of the homes have solar panels that are generating 4,000 kilowatt hours a year each. Pretty small solar system. Total grid electricity use for this neighborhood is now 65,000 kilowatt hours. After converting everything to heat pumps, including the gas heat at home, after converting the cars from gasoline to electricity. This is an attempt to illustrate the point that I was making with those more abstract graphs a moment ago, is that the conversion to electricity actually brings with it the possibility of reducing total electricity use. It seems like an oxymoronic thing to say, but it's true. And some of you probably know this from personal experience if you've made that transition in your own home. Then we did the same with cars and trucks. Here, again, the electricity use is broken into two slivers, one for the personal vehicles, that's the darker one, and one for the trucks. And this is all the road transportation vehicles converted to electricity by 2050, with the cars growing sooner and the trucks really accelerating in the 2030s. And here's the fossil fuel use that gets displaced by that. Cars, electric vehicles are like 4 and 5 times more efficient than their fossil fuel counterparts. So even with growth, that population and vehicle growth, even with that baked in to this result, this is the total amount of energy use all of the road transportation fleet in New Brunswick is using after electrification compared to what it was using before. So we go from 40 to about 10. And that includes all the new vehicles from that population growth. This is one of the most powerful drivers of the economic case for the conversion. You'll see, by the way, the Class 8 trucks, which I didn't put in my scenario. And Class 8 trucks, by the way, are these big guys that pull the big 18-wheelers and more around. I don't really have them coming on strong for another 7 or 8 years in my scenario. If you've been to Europe recently, they're already on the highways there. You won't see a lot of them, but you'll start to spot them. And they're hauling loads from Oslo to Rome, from from Turkey to Portugal. The charging stations are there. The drivers are happy. The maintenance costs them down. The trucks are still more expensive, a lot more expensive, but that won't last for long. And so we were pretty aggressive in assuming that, yes, we are going to electrify the trucks. We left off the off-road stuff, and in the conversation with the MLAs today, they brought this up. They said, you know, when it comes to the equipment that's in the woods and up north and so on, electrification is a hard sell, and we haven't touched that yet. We're going to take a look at it this winter, but all of the road transportation, which is where most of the energy use is converted to electricity in this scenario, including the big trucks. And here you can see just a breakdown between the personal vehicles, the light commercial trucks, so these are the pickups and the light vans, the medium trucks, these are the bigger vans that you see around the cities, and then the Class 8 heavy trucks and buses, transit buses and so on up here. And you have a completely electric transportation sector. We relied heavily on the capital premiums published by the Renewable Energy Lab in the United States, one of the authoritative sources on this type of thing. They publish capital premium estimates for all kinds of cars along with efficiency levels. They do the same for different electricity sources, and we used quite a bit of that input data as well in estimating capital costs for electricity. When we apply those capital costs to the scenario I just showed you for converting, and this is a Canada-wide graph you're looking at now, you can see that by the later years in the scenario, the personal electric vehicles are actually projected to cost less than their combustion counterparts. I mean, the Chinese have already achieved this. There's no reason for electric cars to be as expensive, never mind more expensive than combustion vehicles. They have fewer parts. They're fundamentally simpler pieces of machine than those Flintstone-like things I referred to earlier, where you're trying to control explosions as a way to move forward. It's a much more elegant approach to achieving mobility, and it will be cheaper. And so there's a capital cost premium. With the trucks, according to the National Lab capital cost data that we used, even by 2050, they'll still be somewhat more expensive than they are now. Right now, you'll pay as much as $300,000 premium for a big Class 8 truck as compared with a diesel one. So there's a ways to go in bringing that down. I think it's still sitting at about $100,000 by 2035 and drops to about $50,000 by 2050. I think those costs are going to come down faster and deeper, but we didn't go there. A couple of other really fascinating things that people always get interested in when I mention it, so I'll say a word about it. I mentioned it earlier. We rely in this work on what's called vehicle-to-grid technology, where the electric cars become the batteries that the grid uses to smooth out the intermittency of wind and solar supply. This graph represents charging of the electric vehicles, all of the space between the black dotted line and the top solid line, and anywhere where that dotted line is above the black solid line, that's where the vehicles are feeding back to the grid. It's quite beautiful. It's such a powerful concept. There's no doubt in my mind we will look back at electric vehicles, not so much as a change in the way that we get around, but as the advent of millions of portable batteries. This is the final bottom line for electricity use. In New Brunswick, in our scenario, our reference scenario, we did a number of different scenarios. And you can see reflected the earlier comments that building electricity use, residential and commercial buildings, are these first two layers, fairly steady over the time period. Here's the growth from the cars and the trucks going electric. And then this gray part, this is the industrial and non-road transport electricity use growing by about 60%. And we're going to take a much closer look at that this winter. It may go up. I think it may come down, but we'll see. We included it because we wanted to make sure we had the electricity in our electricity supply scenario. The shape of the electricity use is important in this future. This is what it looks like in New Brunswick now on the left-hand side. You already have a strong winter peak in this province. So the transition to electricity in New Brunswick doesn't really represent nearly as much of a change as it does in provinces that do not use electricity right now for heating. Everything goes up, of course, because you're using more electricity. You can see the cars and the trucks here are this. This is a weekly weekly graph. This goes from January to December. This is the air conditioning load here. What you're looking at is the weekly consumption in 2050 after decarbonization in New Brunswick. So everything is higher, but the shape of demand on a week-to-week basis over the year really isn't that much different from what it is today. It presents a big challenge now, and it will continue to present a challenge, as it does for any northern country that tries to electrify its buildings with whether you do it with renewable or anything else. You are going to need a lot of generating capacity in the winter that you're not necessarily going to need for most of the rest of the year. As I mentioned earlier, the supply of the electricity needs to be renewable. This analysis was done at the level of the Maritimes, so PEI, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick. For reasons I won't go into, some of you may know, though, that there are data issues when you try to do supply analysis in this country, province by province, for the Maritimes. So here you see the growth in wind power. As I mentioned earlier, wind is the heavy workhorse of the transition everywhere in Canada, but particularly, I think, here in the Maritimes. Here is the existing hydro. This includes the assumption that the current flow over the Maritime link will continue. This is Point Lepreau shutting down as scheduled in 2032, I guess it is. The space between this black line, which is basically consumption, and the renewable supply, that's going to have to continue to be provided by fossil. Or maybe it'll be smaller if we can grow this supply quicker, or if some of those conservative assumptions about demand I mentioned don't work out. But it will take most of the 2030s in this scenario to completely phase out the use of non-renewable electricity in the Maritimes. Now, depending on how the cross-Canada transmission line thing works out, it may be possible to move this forward quite dramatically. We're going to be looking at that in more detail. But this isn't going to be quick. If we had time to look at some of the other provinces, you would see, obviously, much easier in British Columbia, Manitoba, and Quebec, where they've got Newfoundland is swimming in hydro. They've got so much hydro compared to their own needs there that there's really not much incentive to build wind except for the possibility of being able to put it on a national grid. This is the year 2050 in the Maritimes. Another way of looking at it, this chart goes from January to December in 2050 and again shows the seasonal decline in wind that occurs here in the summer months compared to the winter months. And here you see the demand. In any place where the black line is a little bit above the green, we're going to have to use demand management or fossil backup or some other strategy for closing what I call the last 100 hours. And when we were doing this simulation, we said, we're going to make sure that renewables by 2050 are supplying all of the electricity for 8,660 hours of the year. If we increase that to 8,760, which is the total number of hours in the year, the cost of that last 100 hours, if you do it with turbines and supply, is quite high. And I don't think that's how it will happen. I think it will happen with demand management, with advances in storage technology, and with some existing legacy fossil resources possibly still being in use. And here in the Maritimes, some of it will be wood stoves. Now, this is kind of interesting. It's January on the left and July on the right. Again, this is for the Maritimes, not just New Brunswick. And it just shows the demand for electricity on the top and the supply on the bottom. So here you see the space heating load in January. Here you see the air conditioning load in the summer. And, you know, if you want to get into this, the full report's going to be available in 2 or 3 weeks from now, and there's hundreds of pages that you can pour through to understand this. But the overall impression that you should take away from just looking at a graph like this is that this future is possible. This is a better map of where we need to go than those guys had in 1490 when they set sail, thinking they were heading for China. We've got enough information now to get on with it. And a couple of other really positive findings from this is that when all of that fossil fuel disappears from our building energy use and from our vehicle energy use, that's money we're not spending anymore. And it adds up to a lot of money. This is these are the numbers for Atlantic Canada. Right now, somewhere between $14 and $15 billion a year is spent in Atlantic Canada by households and businesses and institutions and so on, by everybody, for fuel and electricity. About $5 billion of that is for electricity, and the rest is for fuel, heating fuel, transportation fuel, industrial fuel, and so on. In a business-as-usual scenario, and the details of what I mean by that, again, are spelled out in the report, there will be an increase in the electricity bill here over time, but there will also be an increase in the fossil fuel spending over time. In our reference decarbonization scenario, which is the chart on the far right, what you can see is still some spending on fossil fuels, but it's all in the industrial sector, and electricity spending on electricity is now up to somewhere around $7.5 billion. But the total expenditure on fuel and electricity is sitting at just over $8 billion compared to $15 billion today. And this occurs right across the country, province by province. The renewable electricity future is a future in which spending on fuel and electricity goes down, even as we double the supply of electricity, even as we decarbonize all of these buildings. Now, that's not the whole story, because the investments that it will take to put all of those heat pumps in, the premiums for all of those electric vehicles, all of that has to be paid for. And what this chart shows, again for the Maritimes, is a year-by-year estimate of the capital premiums for getting off fossil fuels in the Maritimes. And you can see that it gets up to a total of $7 billion in the peak year, which is 2037. And then it starts to decline, because this is an S-curve. It accelerates, and then as we approach 100% electrification, it reaches a plateau and levels off, and the annual spending starts to decline. What these other three lines represent is how much that will cost if we finance it, if we annualize those payments. Think of it as like a mortgage. These are the ticket prices of the houses, but this is how much we'll have to pay per year, given the lifetime of these investments, to pay it off at different interest rates. This solid line on the top is 7.5%, a pretty respectable return for even a private investor. This dotted line on the bottom is 3.5%, more or less the government's cost of capital. And then in the middle, I think it's 5.5%. So what you're seeing here is the powerful impact that the public investor can have on the cost of this transition. If we're smart enough and bold enough to spend less and invest more, hey, that's a good phrase, there is a way to do this which is quite affordable and quite manageable, and it will be much cheaper if we bring public money, not spending, this would be paid back through whatever mechanisms, but public investment in the mix, so that we can get the blended finance rate for this transition, for the vehicles and the housing retrofits and the heat pumps of all of that, down to, let's say, 5.5%, where the cost becomes much more manageable than if this is left to private sector, and we go on about the implications of that. This transition that I've been focused on isn't the only transition that's going to be going on. This is a wicked complicated world we live in. It's expensive, but so what? I mean, we do expensive things all the time. I don't understand why the capital intensity of this is put forward as some kind of fundamental barrier. It didn't stop us from building the tar sands or nuclear power plants or the freeway system or the St. Lawrence Seaway or any number of other incredibly capital-intensive undertakings that Canadians have done in the past 100 years. In this case, why should it stop us now? We just need to develop the financing and business solutions that can spread those costs out the way we've done it for those other projects so that the burden of the upfront costs is taken off the household and the private firm. Role of local governments is really, I could go on for an hour about that. I spent 10 years of my life focused on helping governments around the world. This is actually the official tie of Helsinki, which I got years ago when working with the city of Helsinki in their climate strategy, possibly the most energy efficient city in the world. It's between them and Copenhagen. So it's time to go. That's a message to me, by the way. That's telling me. But you can take it at another level. You know, this economy is taking off. We're tracking this at corporate nights. We're seeing much faster growth in the revenue and the investment in all of these options than we're seeing in the overall average rates of investment and growth. It's phenomenal to see the growth rates that are happening. This is investment in these solutions is now outpacing the old economy by a good margin, and it did it all through the pandemic. It's partly because of these historic drops in the price of batteries and solar and and wind turbines, and it's partly because the world is trying to solve this problem. North America runs the risk of falling behind. You can see that in this chart. The red at the, well, the... This is billions of dollars per year of investment in climate solutions. This is APAC, so Asia and Pacific, in other words, China, mainly. This next sort of greenish section, this is Europe, as well as the Middle East and Africa, but mainly Europe. And here on the top you have the Americas, mainly the United States, but also Canada. And you can see, and if, for those of you who travel around the world, you can physically see it. I mean, go to Norway. It's like going to the future. And we are running the risk in this country of missing the boat. And I wanted to end with the flag of New Brunswick. You guys have the best flag. All the other provinces have got like dead leaves and animal heads and abstract designs. Here we've got a lot going on. The boat is in motion. You can't see the people, but you know they're there because the oars are all lined up. I suppose Irving is up top in the cabin, and the rest of us are down below pulling those oars. But still, the wind is blowing. It's renewable. You've got the wind in your back. I love this flag. And I think that when you combine it with the province's motto, hope was restored. And the boat, as I understand it, represents a number of things, one of which is the voyage to this place from somewhere that needed to be left to somewhere where new hope could be engendered and nurtured and developed. Hence, the motto of New Brunswick, hope was restored. We've got another journey we have to make. It's not so much a physical journey this time as it is a journey to bring our behavior back within those planetary limits that I mentioned earlier. And that is the key to restoring hope. And that is, I think, one of the many ways in which this story intersects with the future of New Brunswick. So go for it. Rock the boat. Thank you.